a brief presentation on the introducing the subject of PCBs, or PCBs 101, if you will, and the issues of PCBs in schools. After which, we will hear from Ken Thomas, research physical scientist with the Exposure Measurement and Analysis Branch of the EPA, and Peter Thorne, professor and head of the Department of Occupational and Environmental Health at the University of Iowa. So, PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, they're a group of related chemicals that are semi-volatile or organic in nature, and they vary only by the number and configuration of the chlorine substitutions on the biphenyl ring. So if you could just dredge up a little of your organic chemistry and look at the top panel on the left side is a biphenyl ring with a single chlorine substitution. And these various arrangements of chlorines on the biphenyl ring are called congeners. In its entirety, there are 209 unique structural combinations of chlorine substitution on the biphenyl ring, and so there are 209 what we call PCB congeners. The simplest one that gets designated number PCB1 is the one you see on the left, which is a single chlorine substitution, and then you add chlorines in various different types of configurations. Remember, these are three-dimensional molecules, and ultimately, PCB 209 is the one on the far right where you just have complete chlorine substitution on the biphenyl ring. PCBs were manufactured worldwide, mostly through from 1930 to the late 70s. In the United States, Monsanto was the primary, not the exclusive, but the primary producer, and under the trade name of Arochlor. And so you've often seen that name associated with PCBs. They also use their own unique naming system for the PCB mixtures that they produce, calling them Arochlor with four numbers afterwards. The first two, the 12, which is common to all of the ones except one, which I'll explain, just designates the number of carbons in the biphenyl ring. And the last two numbers designates the average weight of the chlorine in that particular mixture mix. And as you see on that bottom panel, that there are a number of them, and as you go from lighter, you know, to the heavier ones on this chart. And so again, Arochlor 1221 has an average chlorine weight of the congeners in that mix of 21%. And as you can see on the right side of that bottom panel, each of these Arochlors actually had quite a few individual congeners, generally between 60 and 100. So it's not a very exacting way to name PCBs, and I think our presenters will probably be talking more about, you know, the difference between an Arochlor analysis, a homolog analysis, and what we call a congener analysis.
Hello, Mark. This is Justin. Just really quick, sorry to interrupt. A few people have said that they cannot hear you very well, so I just wanted to make sure that you speak directly into the phone.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will get closer to the phone, and I hope I'm being heard a little bit better now.
It's coming through loud and clear. Thank you.
Okay, great. So the so what we see now is just two chromatograms for Arochlor 1242 and the 1254. What you could notice is that the 1242 has a mixture of lighter or less chlorinated congeners skewed towards the left or towards the lower chlorination. The one on the bottom, 1254, is more heavily chlorinated. I think my colleague Ken Thomas gave me this slide. 1242 was the one that was most often used in the ballast of lighting fixtures, and 1254, the slightly heavier, less volatile arachlor was often put in caulking material. And just a note about this one arachlor that doesn't follow the naming scheme, 1016. That was brought on, it didn't have a long history. It was just, I think, introduced in the early 70s, and not long before they were all phased out, as a replacement to 1242. And it has 41% chlorine by weight, almost the same as the 1242, except that it had fewer of the congeners with more than four chlorine substitutions. I guess they were looking for, less persistence. But anyway, and I don't know why they departed from their otherwise naming scheme and didn't call that one 1241, but whatever. Moving on, it's worth noting some of PCB's properties, because that's what gave them their commercial attractiveness. Electrical insulation, which is the reason they were put in the ballast of lighting fixtures, they're flame resistant, their plasticizers, and again, that was why they were mostly added to caulking material to prevent it from drying out and give it more pliability. Chemical stability, durability. All of these desirable properties for commercial use were less desirable from an environmental impact standpoint. That stability and durability made them very persistent in the environment, which is usually not a particularly good thing. Even though they're semi-volatile and not terribly volatile, the lighter ones, and all of them to some extent can vaporize and migrate to into the air, as we'll clearly see, and into other substrates. And they are very fat soluble, so they tend to be persistent, in humans, accumulating in fat tissue. And as we'll learn, if you tune in next week, they have all sorts of toxic effects, which we will not discuss today. Now, just to start to talk about the schools issue, there could have been any number of components or products within buildings where we might find PCBs, and you'll see that on the left, and on the right in the pink is a number of again, substrates where we clearly have identified PCBs. And those two tops are, those are the big sticker items, the ballast and the fluorescent light fixtures and the caulking material, and then to a lesser extent other types of glazings, joint sealants, sealing coatings, and spray-on fireproofing materials and paints. So before I hand it over to my esteemed colleagues, I just want to discuss for a moment how I was introduced to the subject of PCBs in schools. And back in 2008, I received a call from my colleagues at the New York City Department of Health. Could I assist them with this PCBs and caulk issue? I thought they were talking about the stoppers you pull out of wine bottles. Caulk, caulk. I'm a guy with a Brooklyn accent. It all sounded the same to me. And I'm also a person that enjoys a glass of wine, and my initial impression was, geez, first we have the lead in the foil wrappers, and now there's PCBs in the cork. I'm thinking all the more reason to move over to screw tops. But that initial impression was quickly corrected, and while the presence of PCBs in sealant material, aka cork, was news to me at the time, it wasn't entirely off the radar screen. And so let me just bring up this school that the health department was calling about. This is a PS 199, and you could see a picture of it on the screen. It's elementary K through 6. It was built in 1963, which is notable because, I mean, that was the 60s was like prime time for the use of PCBs in commercial products. It was also happened to be, at the same time when a lot of schools were being built to accommodate the baby boomers, of which I'm one. It has a fairly large enrollment, 880, and it's located on the upper west side of Manhattan, just a few blocks from Lincoln Center. Just to backpedal a minute, for a moment, the reason they were analyzing for PCBs at this school is an interesting little history. And this got on the radar screen, if you will, back in 2004 when Robert Herrick at Harvard wrote an article or submitted a piece at an EHP, a study of 24 buildings in the Boston area, and he sampled for exterior cork, and of those 24 buildings, 13 contained PCBs at greater than 50 parts per million, which thing of unique about 50 is it's just a TSCA, Toxic Substances Control Act, designation for what constitutes a PCB containing material. And as you can see that some of the samples were quite high, and the mean was over 15,000 parts per million. So a year later, a concerned parent in a New York City suburb school where window replacement had occurred 2 years previously had gotten knowledge of this paper and obtained some exterior cork samples and found 38,000 parts per million. And that person did a fairly good job of publicizing these results and reached out, among others, to one of the New York tabloids, the Daily News, and which publicized the issue. And then in 2008, back up to the present, if you will, some of that publicity caught the attention of the PS199 community where window replacement was occurring, and cork samples were obtained from that school, and some had extremely high concentrations, some samples over 100,000 parts per million. And as we say, the rest is history. I know this is my last slide, and it's a little busy, and it just it gives some of the early rounds of the indoor air sampling in PS199, and you could see along the top, just for context, that background levels in urban ambient air are pretty low, generally from less than 1 nanogram to maybe as high as 10 nanograms per cubic meter. And what you see here on the screen is levels that are orders of magnitude above that. This is obviously a significant level, and even more so significant in that the reason I was called into this was to help develop the exposure guidelines and a risk-based exposure guideline for a school like 199 with elementary would be 300 nanograms per cubic meter, and you could see there are a number of situations here where that's been exceeded. Now, I just would like to say one thing that exceeding that, the less risk assessment initiated amongst this group, this exceeding an exposure guideline doesn't in and of itself mean you would expect an adverse effect. I mean, we don't set exposure guidelines at effects levels, but when you, as you begin to exceed exposure guidelines, you begin to compromise that margin of safety that's built into the risk assessment process, and that's a concern. So at this point, I'll wrap up, and I want to turn it over to my colleague, K. Kent Thomas, who has been absolutely instrumental in helping us understand the nature and extent of the PCB problems in New York City schools. So Kent is a scientist at US EPA's National Exposure Research Laboratory in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. He has 34 years experience in conducting research to assess human exposure to environmental contaminants. His research includes measuring pollutants and exposure to people in buildings and residential environments, understanding dietary exposures to chemical contaminants, and assessing exposure in epidemiologic investigations. Kent is currently the project leader for cumulative risk assessment research and life cycle human exposure modeling research in EPA's Chemical Safety for Sustainability program. He is also working in the Sustainable and Healthy Communities program on improving our understanding of children's exposures to environmental chemicals. Kent, the floor is yours.
Hey, Mark. Thank you very much. I appreciate that introduction. And I'd like to thank all of the people. It seems like we've got very many people joining us today from across the country. So welcome to everybody, and thanks for spending some of your time today. So as Mark said, my talk is labeled Sources and Levels of PCBs in Indoor Environments, but I'm really going to focus on the school aspect of this issue. I'm going to try to cover at a fairly high level today a lot of material ranging from sources of PCBs in school buildings to the emissions from those sources, highlight some of the environmental levels that have been found in school buildings. I'm going to spend most of the talk is about total PCBs and largely based on aerochlor measurements, but I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about some congener-specific measurements. I'm going to switch gears a little bit at that point and talk about what we've learned from this with regard to the potential for exposures to PCBs in schools by children. And finally, a couple slides on additional resources that the agency has developed that might be interested to people attending today's webinar. So I think Mark did a really good job of giving the background for why this is important. You know, we asked the question, why study PCBs in school buildings? While it hasn't been totally unrecognized over the past few decades that PCBs can be present in school buildings because of the materials and components they contain, in recent years we've wanted to get more and better information, and that's really to help us characterize the problem and to inform decision-making, and that takes a couple of different aspects, as you can see here. Part of that is to better understand how do we assess buildings with regard to PCBs? What are good methods and approaches for doing measurements? How many do we need? What materials? What media, et cetera? And of course, the reason we're interested in this kind of information is when it's needed, we'd like to be able to inform best practices for exposure reduction and remediation. And you can see these boxes on the right and left go through some of the questions that one might ask in approaching building assessment and decisions about remediation. And as Mark said, you know, the emphasis here is on buildings that were built or renovated between about 1950 and the late 1970s when these PCBs were used largely in buildings. So we've done some research here in the Office of Research and Development at EPA on this topic. I'm going to speak to you today about the sources, environmental levels, and exposures, but I just wanted to make folks aware that our colleagues in the National Risk Management Laboratory have done some laboratory-based work on this topic here, and I've listed some of the work that they've done in terms of emissions and transport and absorption, looking at some remediation methods, and doing a literature review on remediation methods with Environmental Health and Engineering up in Boston. So when we got into this a few years ago, we posed some basic questions. You know, can we characterize important primary and secondary sources of PCBs in school buildings? So a definition here, we consider primary sources to be materials or components that were that contained PCBs when they were installed in the building. We consider secondary sources to be those that have absorbed PCBs emitted from those primary sources over the last, 30, 40, 50, 60 years. Another question, what level of PCBs can be found in the environmental media in these schools when PCB sources are present? We can then ask, with these PCBs in these environmental media, how much exposure might occur to building occupants? And again, to help inform remediation, we'd like to know what the most important routes of exposure are in these buildings. So just a real high-level synopsis of our research approach. We looked at primary sources, including caulk and light ballast, based on information from 6 schools. This includes the 5 schools as part of the New York City pilot remediation program. We looked at materials that could serve as secondary sources from 3 of these schools. And then we used this information along with the laboratory-based information to do some emission rate estimations. We've summarized information about the environmental levels in the air, surface, and soil for these 6 schools and the dust from 1 school. We looked at within and between school variability and some of the correlations between media. At the 1 school where we got into and did some intensive work, we also made congener-specific measurements, and this can help us inform us about sources and patterns that might be found in these buildings. And finally, we took this information and applied an exposure model we had previously developed to estimate PCB exposure distributions for different child age groups, and again, to look at the relative importance of different exposure pathways. So thinking about caulk and other sealants as PCB sources, just a little bit of background information. The production of PCBs as plasticizer ingredients ramped up during the late 1950s, peaked in 1969 at about 19 million pounds produced, and then the manufacturer decided they were going to discontinue manufacture for this use, and so it went down to about 0 by 1971. But it's also important to recognize that PCBs were sometimes added to caulk during the construction process itself. These sealants with PCBs were actually considered to be high-quality materials, and they were used in a lot of places, exterior and interior windows and doors, exterior and interior joints. It's been found in some window glazing, and potentially could occur in a number of other locations where you might need a sealant, whether it's a caulk or some other kind of sealant. And as Mark mentioned, under TSCA regulations, caulk with greater than 50 parts per million is not an allowed use. So what happens if you go in and collect samples in some schools? What are you likely to find? So in 5 schools with over 400 caulk measurements, 82% had less than 50 parts per million, while 6% had greater than 100,000 parts per million. The exterior caulks from 73 samples at 3 schools, 37% of those had less than 50 parts per million, while 34% had more than 100,000 parts per million. And just a quick note that 100,000 parts per million is 10% PCBs by weight. So why is this an issue, finding PCBs in sealant material? Well, one of the problems is PCBs can move over time into the adjoining wood, cement, and brick. It can be emitted into the air, and through the air it can contaminate dust inside buildings. Exterior PCB-containing sealants, the PCBs can leach into the soil near the building. And as I noted, PCBs, as they move around, can be absorbed by other materials and furnishings in a building. Although these caulks and sealants were installed 40 to 60 years ago, in some cases high PCB levels remain, and where this is the case, emissions are likely to continue far into the future. In our work, we found that caulk with high PCB levels is usually still flexible and often largely intact, meaning, of course, it's doing the job it was intended to do in the first place. But we've also learned that visual identification of caulk with PCBs is not likely to be particularly reliable. So one of the other major sources in buildings are these fluorescent light ballasts, and both fluorescent and high-intensity light ballast capacitors, many if not most of these probably contain PCBs prior to 1977. 77 to 78 was a transition period, and after 1978, no new ballasts were manufactured with PCBs in the United States. Most ballasts with measurements have been found to contain 1242 or the similar Aerochlor 1016, but we should note that one ballast was found in a New York City school with Aerochlor 1254, and there are reports that Aerochlor 1254 was used early in the manufacture of these capacitors for light ballasts. Most PCB-containing ballasts, if not all, have exceeded their expected lifetime. Because of this, failure and release of PCBs will continue and may potentially increase where these ballasts remain in place today. This table just shows a quick summary of a survey of fluorescent light ballasts across five of the six schools. And as you can see, anywhere from 24% to 95% of the ballasts in these particular schools were found to likely be containing PCBs. We don't know nationwide what the percent is. Many school systems have done lighting retrofits, so we don't know to what extent this is likely to represent the situation further across the country. In our laboratory work, we found that PCBs are continuously released into the air from intact functioning light ballasts. When the lights are off, these emissions are very low. When the lights are on, the ballast heats up, and these emissions increase several fold. We know that PCB ballasts can fail, and when that happens, sometimes they can release PCB vapors into the air and liquid PCBs onto surfaces. When this happens, the air levels of PCBs can become quite large, surfaces can become contaminated, and there can be significant impacts and costs to remediate the situation where it occurs. It's also been observed that residues from previously failed ballasts can remain in light fixtures, even if the ballast itself has been replaced. Okay, so we're going to switch gears from what we call primary sources to what we're characterizing as secondary sources. And again, PCBs released from primary sources are absorbed over time in other materials in the school environment. Following removal of primary sources, PCBs in these secondary sources may be released into the school environment and result in continuing exposures. In some cases, secondary sources may need to be considered for additional remedial action following removal or remediation of primary sources. So this slide just gives you a snapshot of what we're talking about. So in three schools that had caulk and fluorescent light ballast primary sources, 93% of the 411 building material samples collected had measurable levels of PCBs. We give some examples of the median and maximum PCB concentrations in these materials. And again, these are total PCB levels measured as aerochlors. So they ranged from a median of 39 and maximum of 720 parts per million to paint, down to a lower amount of about 4 parts per million with a maximum of 57 part per million for floor tiles. And this just gives you a sense of some of the more common and some of the higher surface area materials in these buildings. We think that paint may be an important secondary source due both to its relatively high concentrations and its high surface area in buildings. Dust is going to be an important secondary source of ingestion and inhalation exposures in buildings. So using some of these measured values for materials and using some of the chamber, the laboratory chamber generated work here in RTP, we wanted to try to find out what kinds of emissions we might expect from these materials. So we did some work to estimate relative comparisons for multiple materials that can help feed mitigation decisions and to assess the potential importance of these secondary sources. The emission rates were based on the laboratory chamber emission measurements of caulk and light ballasts. We applied the caulk PCB emission parameters to other materials like paints and floor tiles, although there's a lot of uncertainty in doing this. And so all of these estimation approaches rely on assumptions and have uncertainties. And for the ballast and other materials, the results really should be considered screening level only. So I'm just going to highlight a few examples. In this first slide, these are example estimates of total PCB emission rates from caulk. We did this for several school locations that had caulks with greater than 50,000 parts per million of PCBs. You can see these charts represent a school cafeteria, a gymnasium, a corridor, and another classroom. We estimated that the total PCB emission rates could range from 53 to 3,100 micrograms per hour in these locations. The emission rates depended on both the PCB concentration and the surface area of the caulk. We didn't specifically estimate or model temperature effects, but chamber studies do show a strong temperature effect on emissions. Anywhere from 3 to 5 or 6-fold increases in emissions with a 10-degree Celsius increase in temperatures. So this slide is a little bit more complex. We wanted to try to better understand the emissions or the potential emissions from these light ballasts. So in this example, we were trying to estimate the total PCB emissions for just a couple of scenarios. These emission rates were estimated based on the measurement of several congeners in chamber tests from 4 intact ballasts at 45 degrees Celsius, or approximately the operating temperature. We found that across these 4 ballasts that were tested in a chamber, there was about a 60-fold difference in emissions. So really, this is more of a range-finding kind of estimate. Trying to estimate total PCB emission rates from these intact operating ballasts could range anywhere from about 1 microgram per hour for a classroom with 3 ballasts emitting at the lowest rate up to potentially 290 micrograms per hour for a classroom with 9 ballasts emitting at the highest rate. As part of this effort, we did not estimate emissions from leaking ballasts or contaminated light fixtures, but those might be significant sources of PCBs in the air. And finally, this slide shows an example of some screening level estimates of total PCB emissions from some of these other materials that might be considered secondary sources. Again, these were based on the emission parameters derived for caulk as part of the chamber studies. And therefore might not be completely applicable to all these other different kinds of materials. And so again, these are screening levels, but we did this just to get a relative sense of what more or less secondary source importance might be. So the emission rates for individual materials range from less than 1 to about 100 micrograms per hour in classrooms. The emission rates for individual materials in gyms range from less than 1 to about 1,100 micrograms per hour, and paints had the highest estimated emission rates due to both the higher PCB levels and their high surface areas. But it's important to recognize the effect of these emissions on indoor air PCB levels is complicated because these materials also act as sinks. That is, they will continue to dynamically absorb PCBs from the air. Okay, so given that there are sources of PCBs in school buildings, and we've characterized to some extent the kinds of emissions that might be expected, what do we see in terms of concentrations in environmental media? So this slide just is a highlight slide of the measurements across 6 schools. Where we're showing the median indoor air concentration of about 318 nanograms per cubic meter with a maximum up to about 2,900. Surface wipe samples were collected from both high contact surfaces, that is tables and desks, and low contact surfaces, which are things like floors and walls and windowsills. The concentrations here were 0.15 to 0.2 microgram per 100 square centimeter, ranging up to a maximum of between about 2 and 3 micrograms per 100 square centimeter. In the one school where we collected dust samples, the median concentration was 22 parts per million, ranging up to 87 parts per million. The outdoor soil concentrations at the median level were, the distribution showed less than the quantifiable limit. At the 75th percentile, half a foot from the building, the concentration was about 2 parts per million, 3 feet from the building about 0.55, and below the quantifiable limit once you got out to 8 feet from the building. And you see those kind of results reflected at higher concentrations at the maximum levels. Outdoor air concentrations using the methods that were applied for these buildings were less than the quantifiable limit, so had relatively little impact on what was being measured inside the schools. So the graph on the upper left shows the distributions of total PCB measurements in indoor air at these six schools. A couple things to note about this. First, the PCB concentrations in air exceeded EPA recommended levels in many school rooms, where the recommended levels range from 70 all the way up to 600 nanograms per cubic meter, depending on the particular age group that occupies those spaces. We also noticed there was a lot of variability both within schools and between schools. For example, within school, variability, tenfold variability was observed in some cases. And so this is important when you're trying to figure out how best to assess these buildings. For the surface wipes, the graph is shown on the lower left. Most of the surface wipes in these schools had less than 1 microgram per 100 square centimeter. And again, there was considerable within and between school variability. Soil concentrations varied greatly between schools, and to some extent this depended on whether they had exterior caulks with high PCB concentrations. Some levels were greater than 1 parts per million, and in general, levels decreased with increasing distance from the buildings, as might be expected if the sealants and caulks are the source of the PCBs in soil. So we looked at correlations between PCB concentrations in each case where we had samples collected in the same room across a lot of different rooms. We looked at the correlations between indoor air and high contact surface wipes, also the correlation with low contact surface wipes and between the surface wipes in 64 different building rooms. For the indoor air high contact surface wipe correlation, it was a modest correlation that showed some statistical significance in this setting. The correlations were lower and somewhat less significant for the other two correlations. The bottom chart, we only had 7 measurements to do this, comparing the correlation for indoor air and dust. As we might expect from what we know about SVOCs in building, we saw a fairly high correlation, but with 7 measurements, we've got to be careful about not over-interpreting this result. Okay, so what I've talked about so far have been primarily based on total PCB measurements that were made using an Aerochlor sample analysis method. The Aerochlor method is often used because it's relatively quick and it's typically has a lower cost than collecting and analyzing samples for congener-specific measurements. This table shows the comparison, though, for one school in which we had both Aerochlor and congener measurements, and these represent analyses of actually the same sample extracts. First, we show the mean concentration for the Aerochlor analyses and then the mean concentration if you add up all the individual congeners that were measured. And as you can see, in this case, the Aerochlor analysis gave us total PCB levels that were on average about 20% higher than those we got with the congener analysis. This perhaps isn't too surprising because the congeners in these different materials and in different school environmental media don't perfectly match the aerochlor patterns, the original aerochlor mixtures that were put into some of these materials. There has been differential emission and differential weathering over time. So the important take-home message from this is you've got to be a little bit careful when you're interpreting aerochlor measurements in these situations. In theory, it is possible to either underestimate or overestimate the concentrations depending on the specifics of how the calibration is performed and the actual distribution of different congeners in these media. So given that, you can do some interesting things once you've got these congener-specific measurements, and this is just one example. We organize the congener measurements into homolog groups, that is, into groups that had one chlorine, another group that includes the congeners with two chlorines, three chlorines, etc. For the pie charts, the upper left shows the pattern for aerochlor 1242, which is dominated by 2, 3, and 4 chlorine congeners. And the upper right shows aerochlor 1254, which is dominated by 4, 5, and 6 chlorine congeners. And then we can compare our measurements in different media to that. So the bottom left, we see the homolog pattern for indoor air at this one school. And again, it looks like it's got mostly 4, 5, and some 6, and some 3 chlorine congeners. When we look at the exterior caulk from this building, which had the high concentrations in it, the pattern looks like 4, 5, and 6 chlorine congeners predominate. So compared to aerochlor 1254 in this situation, the air appears to be weighted towards more volatile congeners. Compared to aerochlor 1254, the caulk is weighted towards less volatile congeners, which might be expected if aerochlor 1254 was what was originally used in this material and if some weathering has gone on over the decades. But the air also has higher levels of the less volatile congeners than might be expected based on vapor emissions alone. And this may reflect a couple things. First, it may reflect that we're seeing both vapor phase congeners in the air, but also particle phase congeners. So these are PCBs that have absorbed onto soil or dust, and these dust and soil particles are suspended into the air that people breathe. We also are learning more about emissions, absorption and emissions from these secondary sources that might also be contributing to this phenomenon. Of note here that the aerochlor 1242 pattern did not appear to be reflected in large measure in the indoor air in this building. We don't know what aerochlor the PCB ballast contained in this building, but if it was aerochlor 1242, we are not seeing that pattern to any strong extent in the indoor air in this building. Okay, and so here's another way, of course, you can start looking at the individual congeners. Just real quickly, what these plots represent. In each case, the X scale on these graphs is simply the PCB congener number, ranging from congener number 1 all the way up to congener 209. And some of the more prominent peaks are labeled. For example, PCB 110 has the highest weight percent for aerochlor 1254. The other plots show different media from this one school, and the concentrations of each of the congeners that was measured in these media. And so again, you can begin to look at patterns of different congeners that can help us better understand not only the sources, but the potential for exposures. And the toxicologists certainly think about this on a congener-specific basis once we get into toxicology. So again, the indoor air has got a little bit more of the volatile congeners, but surprising amounts of the less volatile congeners. The exterior caulk and the indoor dust look remarkably similar in terms of their patterns. Okay, so if we can end up having relatively large amounts of PCBs in these indoor and school environments, what does that mean for exposures? Well, occupants in schools with interior sources can be exposed to PCBs in the indoor air, in the dust, and on surfaces through their normal activities. In school buildings with exterior PCB sources, exposures may occur through contact with contaminated soil. And we think that exposures can occur through inhalation, ingestion, and dermal contact. I'm not going to go into much detail on this, but we applied a model that we've developed here in our organization called the Stochastic Human Exposure and Dose Simulation Model. This model inputs distributions of measurements in different environmental media like air and dust and soil. And it takes into account, where we have such data available, human contact information with these media and distributions of human contacts with these media, combined with information or estimates of how these materials are absorbed in different places in the body. We can put all this together to begin to build estimates in a Monte Carlo fashion across a large number of individuals to begin to simulate the range of exposures and doses that might occur from those distributions and contact rates. And so we can output this as estimates of population distributions of exposure or dose. So we use this exposure model to estimate what exposures children might experience using the PCB levels that were measured across the six schools that I've been talking about in this presentation. We found that many of the children would be predicted to receive exposures somewhat above the EPA Integrated Risk Information System reference dose for Aerochlor-1254. We also took measurements taken from the New York City schools following some remedial activities and put those into the model as well. And when we did that, we found that the PCB levels following remediation efforts at several schools, most children would be predicted to receive exposures below that reference dose for Aerochlor-1254. The graph on the upper left kind of shows the before and after remediation for 6 to 10-year-olds and their distributions, and the bottom plot on the left shows the same thing for all four age groups, kind of pre and post mitigation distributions of estimated exposures and doses. A couple of really important points about this. First, these estimates do not include PCB exposures from diet or other sources that occur away from the school. And the other really important point here is these estimates are based on the particular concentrations that were measured in these six schools, and the results could potentially be substantially different for schools that have different levels of PCBs or different distributions across different media. All right, so finally, one of the things we wanted to get out of this using our exposure modeling approach was to try to figure out what's the most dominant or the most important pathway of exposures, because that's what can really help us decide how to mitigate these PCBs in school buildings. So we estimated the amount of the exposure and dose for the simulated children at these six schools. And the plot here shows the estimated amount from dermal absorption, inhalation, non-dietary ingestions from dust, and non-dietary ingestions from residues at different percentiles of our exposure distribution. And as you can see, across most of the distribution of exposures, inhalation would account for more than 70% of the total dose. We do see at the upper percentile of the distribution a case where perhaps ingestion of PCBs and dust could be an important route of exposure. But, you know, the conclusions for this, at least in schools that have the distributions of PCBs that we saw, inhalation would be the primary pathway, but dust can be an important pathway as well when you think about remediation. Okay, so I'm going to come back and just highlight one important point about this. PCBs can be a complex problem in school buildings. Often we're dealing with over 100 different chemicals. There potentially can be multiple primary sources present in a building. We've learned that PCBs can move from their sources into the air, surfaces, dust, and soil, and they can also be absorbed into other materials, thus creating secondary sources. Ventilation and temperature effects can be important, particularly in the movement of PCBs and the amount that we find in the air. And finally, we find that exposures can occur through multiple different pathways. As always, it's important to highlight some of the limitations and uncertainties around this particular work. We don't know the representativeness of the schools that I've shown you today. These are all based in the northeastern United States. We don't know whether the sources or the measured concentrations are representative of schools in other places in the country. We also don't know very well if these results for schools will apply to other types of buildings that might have similar resources. In this work, we weren't able to really tease out the relative importance of caulk and light ballast as primary sources because, in most cases, these buildings contain both types of sources. I don't think we know the potential impact of these contaminated light fixtures. And as Mark noted, there potentially can be other different kinds of sources, particularly primary sources in school buildings. We may not have exhausted the potential for these different sources in the modest number of schools that people have been in. And finally, of course, there are considerable uncertainties in the modeled emission, exposure, and dose estimates. And I'll point out one of the uncertainties we faced in our exposure modeling was having good data for pulmonary absorption of PCBs, both from vapor phase and from particle phase. And we're going to hear from Peter Thorne later where I think some headway is being made in these areas. I'm going to show you a couple of slides that list additional resources. The agency has used information from research within and outside the agency to help develop some current best practices for minimizing exposures. They've published public health levels for PCBs in indoor school air. There's more information on PCBs and caulk and light ballasts, and information for testing, renovation, waste, and some of the regulations. Again, this can be a complex and difficult topic, so if you're faced with assessing and remediating PCB in buildings, it can be a challenge. We strongly recommend you contact your regional EPA PCB coordinator, and if you find yourself dealing with PCBs in buildings, working with certified contractors that have experience in PCB assessment and remediation is recommended. And I'm not going to spend any time on these next two slides where I've listed additional resources from the agency with websites, but be aware that these will be available to you should you want to get more information on this topic. And last slide, I'd like to acknowledge the many individuals and organizations that have contributed to this work and to trying to better understand this problem from the agency's perspective. So, Mark, I hope I hit the time somewhat, but thanks, and I'll turn it back over to you.
Yeah, I think we are right on time. And before we start our next presentation, I'd like to take a few minutes for questions. Let's go to the phones first. If you would like to ask a question, please take your phone off mute, star 7, state your name and organization, and ask your question, and we'll see how well we can answer it. Okay, questions from the phone lines? I'm not going to give you too long because there's plenty that have been typed in. So,
hi, this is Joe Sarcone, and I'm in Anchorage, Alaska with ATSDR. And I know that you're going to get into this next week in terms of health impacts or the potential for health-related impacts from exposure to PCBs, but I find myself going into the Alaska's School Nurses conference on Saturday, this coming Saturday, and I know that one of the things they're going to be interested in is health effects from exposure to PCBs. So, because I need it now and not next week, can somebody just give me a real brief, what should I tell the school nurses on Saturday about exposure to PCBs in children in schools?
This is Mark. I'll begin with that, and then if my either my colleagues want to add, they can, and I would certainly suggest you tune in next week because that'll really be the subject of that discussion. But PCBs don't really have a great deal in the way of acute effects. Probable carcinogens, but that's not the kind of thing you're going to see acutely. And you know, most of their non-carcinogenic systemic effects, center around developmental endpoints and immunologic, and some systemic impacts to the kidney and liver. And it's not something that a clinician would easily recognize. So I wish I had a better answer for you, but I'm sorry that I don't. Kent or Peter, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, let me say, this is Kent. So, one of the reasons for this work is to try to develop the kinds of information and assessment approaches people can use to better understand this topic. And I think what everyone is working towards is, being prudently protective of children and staff members in schools where PCBs and PCB sources are found. That's one of the reasons the agency developed these public health indoor air levels. But as Mark said at the beginning of the presentation, I think, this needs to be considered in the context of, raising the concern when they're found at high levels in buildings. But basically, what we're trying to do is get out of the range of the uncertainties in the effects and back into the more protective range when we're thinking about remediating PCBs in buildings.
That helps.
This is Peter. I would just add one more thing, and that is that animal studies conducted at higher levels, higher doses, have shown that various PCB congeners are carcinogenic developmental toxicants. Some concentrate in the brain and are neurotoxic. So there are a host of adverse health effects that make us want to be trying to control exposures to humans, and particularly with children. So I think that's a large part of why we're interested in identifying these sources and mitigating the hazards to the lowest levels that we can achieve.
Okay. Yeah, that's very helpful. I think I understand now better about when things get into that range of uncertainty that we would take the prudent approach, and I think that's something that I can share that people will understand. Thank you.
Okay, very good. And again, this is Mark. I tried to stress that in the beginning, that the exposure guidelines, it's not an effect level, but said when you exceed those exposure guidelines, you start to chip away at that margin of safety that we operate with. Any other questions on the phone, or else we'll go to the ones that were typed in? Hearing none. We'll have hopefully another opportunity later, but let me go to a couple of questions that we have from Christina Giorgio. Should be able to pronounce an Italian name. Please advise on the proper methods for testing for indoor air levels of PCBs. Does introducing outside air by opening windows or running air conditioners mask the PCB levels in the air? I'll start with Kent, and Peter will add anything if he would like to as well.
Sure. This sounds like it's more under what conditions we'd like to measure PCBs in indoor air rather than the actual methods, but that information is available on some of those additional resources as well. Generally, I think we would really like to know the concentrations under scenarios in which people actually occupy the building. So if most of the time the windows are closed, for example, and if some kind of central ventilation or HVAC system is being used, those are typically the conditions we'd like to make the measurements under. If you're concerned about light ballasts, you'd probably like to have the lights on and operating so those ballasts are working at their higher temperatures. But there may be circumstances as well where natural ventilation, whether it's open windows or doors, are sometimes used, and that might be a relevant thing to measure as well. I think ideally we'd like to have information about concentrations under the range of conditions in which a building is operated, you know, if you can afford to make those that many measurements.
Okay. Peter, would you like to add anything to that?
Nope.
Okay. Now, here's a question from Thompson. Can you tighten up from an exposure guideline to a, quote, safe or hazardous level of one or two PCBs for practical building assessment? Now, I'm being a risk assessor. I'm going to take the first shot at this. I think, as we said, there's no bright line, safe or hazardous level. You know, we use the risk assessment process to come up with an exposure guideline that we believe is safe with an adequate margin. Well, you know, with an adequate margin of safety, but there are no absolutes here. So, you know, the process we have is the best we've been able to develop to date, and so I don't think there's any way to go, you know, beyond that. And so an exposure guideline for one or two PCBs. Now, I think, as our other presenters have said, that, you know, there's a number of different ways of measuring PCBs, but what you're trying to do is measure, you know, everything that's in the air. Now, whether you do it through Arachlor or Congener, is, you know, there's pros and cons of both, but, you know, it wouldn't make sense of just trying to look at one or, you know, two Congeners from an exposure guideline standpoint. So again, Peter or Kent, would you care to add anything to that?
Yeah, so this is Ken, and I'd just like to add one of the challenges is how to get to that that benchmark level for individual PCB congeners. Right now, the EPA has their IRIS value. They've got one for Arachlor 1254 and I believe another for Arachlor 1016. And so often people are trying to make measurements that are relevant compared to those particular Arachlors, for better or for worse. You know, we could see situations where having good enough toxicological information for individual congeners would be helpful in this situation, but I don't know when those are likely to be available to us.
Okay. And this is Peter. Those are RFDs based on ingestion exposure studies, correct?
That's yes, correct. They are, and that's a very good point, Peter. And hopefully you'll do some inhalation studies so that we could get the dose response from the exposure scenario that's most relevant here. Good point. There's a lot of questions. Let me move on. My colleague Jorene Campabiano. One school mentioned to me at a recent schools conference that they have PCB lighting ballasts, but they have disconnected them. Is this still a risk, gentlemen?
I think the risk is potentially minimized if they're disconnected. Again, we've found very low emission rates from even intact ballasts that are, you know, not operating at temperature. But those emissions are really low. You know, potentially the risk here is from failure, although the chances of failure from a non-operating ballast, again, would be pretty low. So it may be mostly a potential risk to people that handle these ballasts, either for removal or for storage. You know, my recommendation would be to consider, going through the proper approach to dispose of those ballasts. And again, the agency has developed some information and guidance on the best ways to do that.
Peter, anything to add to that?
Nope.
Okay. Carl Steinman asks, why aren't emission rates given on a per area basis?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and we've actually calculated those in addition to total PCB emission rates. If you get a chance to get into our technical report, you can see some of that. One of the reasons that we looked at total PCB emissions is we were interested to learn whether or not the rates of emissions we're seeing from these caulks can actually get the PCB levels in indoor air up to some of the levels that have been seen in schools and above these indoor public health school guidelines. And so the answer to that question is, depending on the conditions, we think that it actually can occur. There have been folks that have been skeptical about whether these caulking materials, these sealants, could actually put out enough PCBs to do this. And some people have thought that it's got to be the more volatile congeners and the light ballast that are causing this. But I think there's good evidence from our work and from work done by others in this country and outside of this country to indicate that these sealants can actually, result in indoor air levels of concern.
Okay. Thank you. Let's take one last question because I want to allow plenty of time for the next presentation, and hopefully we'll have yet some more time for Q&A. But Robert Atwood asks, while the data being presented is for six specific schools, can this data be considered to be typical of most schools, or do building variables such as age have a big impact on results? And Kent, you certainly would be in a position to answer this.
Yeah, that's a great question. We try to emphasize that we really don't know the representativeness of these particular results for these particular schools across the United States. Schools in different parts of the country certainly can have different characteristics, not just the materials that are in those schools, but also ventilation systems, the amount of outdoor air that's used for ventilation, building use patterns. All of these things can affect the concentration of PCBs in the air. And school cleaning procedures can also be really important. We're concerned when dust accumulates in buildings with PCB sources because the concentrations can build up and the dust can become a more important exposure source. It would be great to see more data from buildings in other parts of the country to help better understand this problem.
Okay. Thank you, Ken. I know there's still some questions that have been unanswered, but let's get to our next presentation, and hopefully we'll have some time left at the end to go back to the Q&A. Our next presenter is Dr. Peter S. Thorne, is a professor and head of the Department of Occupational and Environmental Health at the University of Iowa College of Public Health. He holds a secondary appointment as a professor of environmental engineering. He received his B.S. in chemical engineering, M.S. in biomedical engineering, and Ph.D. in toxicology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and did postdoctoral training in immunotoxicology at the University of Pittsburgh. He came to the University of Iowa as an assistant professor in 1998. Since 2001, he has served as director of the NIEHS-funded Environmental Health Sciences Research Center at the University of Iowa. Dr. Thorne also directs a project and a research corps in the NIEHS-funded Iowa Superfund Research Program. He has been continuously funded by NIH over two decades and runs a productive research laboratory engaged in studies of environmental risk factors for asthma, inflammatory lung disease, health effects of inhaled PCBs, discussion of today, endotoxin and glucan-induced immunomodulation, nanotoxicology, and novel methodology for exposure assessment to airborne toxicants. Dr. Thorne teaches graduate-level courses on environmental health, human toxicology, and hazards of biological agents, and is co-founder of the Interdisciplinary Graduate Program in Human Toxicology. He has mentored 75 MS, PhD, and postdoctoral trainees. Dr. Thorne has served on a wide variety of editorial and review boards for scientific journals, government agencies, and academia, and on the NIH National Advisory Environmental Health Sciences Council. He is the recipient of the Thomas Bedford Memorial Prize from the British Occupational Hygiene Society and the John Doolittle Award from the Society of Toxicology, and was the 2003 Whitehead Memorial Lecturer at the Children's Hospital of Brooklyn. Peter, take it away.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mark, for that introduction. I'm pleased to be presenting here. I think what I'm going to talk about will fit pretty well as a follow-on to what you just heard from Kent Thomas, and this is some of the recent work that's been going on at the Iowa Superfund Research Program, which is funded through the NIEHS Superfund Research Program itself. Going to the next slide here then, I want to start by just making the point that really the focus, if you look across decades on PCBs, has been ingestion exposure or occupational exposure. And if you look at the thousands of papers out there, the vast majority study either populations that are fish eaters or consume high on the food chain, or our animal studies looking at the ingestion route of exposure. And this is appropriate because of the legacy pollution and especially the bioaccumulation of the highly stable, higher chlorinated congeners. And you've already heard from Mark about the aerochlors and their importance and the sources of these as just discussed. But what we're finding is that as the legacy, some of the legacy pollutant exposures decline, we are seeing modern-day PCB exposures from paints and pigments. And recent work from our Superfund Center by Ding Fei Hu and Carrie Hornbuckle has shown that there are oftentimes dominating the air profile in buildings and in large urban areas are non-aerochlor PCBs. And many of these, such as the list on this slide, PCB 11 on up, are associated with the production of yellow pigment and paint that continues today. So these are, we often think of PCBs as legacy pollutants, but we have to think of them as modern day pollutants as well that are still being produced despite some of the major reductions in production that occurred in 1977. And some of these new congeners are non-aerochlors, meaning that if you're measuring aerochlor profiles, you will not be looking for these PCBs, therefore you will not quantify them. And especially important to this is PCB 11, which I'll talk about quite a bit this afternoon. So we have an increasing awareness of PCBs in schools, as you've just heard. Airborne exposure is an important part of that, and there are all kinds of questions about how do we remediate contaminated schools? How far do we have to go in order to make that a safe environment? And we're talking about the U.S. today, but there's a number of very nice studies from Denmark and Germany and elsewhere that show the importance of caulk, sealants, paints, pigments, and synthetic building materials on the exposures to children and adults in housing and in schools. Another aspect that's happening more so around the country is that many communities are facing a dredging operation that's going on where either because of a navigational need or because of toxicologic remediation, ports, harbors, canals are being dredged, and that material is being removed. And when we excavate those murine or riverine sediments, oftentimes we expose them to layers where they exceed 50 parts per million and therefore become relevant to Superfund legislation. So we've learned a lot about PCBs, and we have this lingering concern. It isn't a problem that's going away. And so we've undertaken to do animal studies and human studies to get a better understanding of what are the absorption, distribution, metabolism, and excretion, and what are the health risks that these impart. So that's what I'm going to talk about in the next bit. I'm going to start with referring to some of the recent animal studies to give a background. So we've been conducting inhalation studies among rodents, and you'd think that this would, with all the thousands of publications on PCBs, there would be many of these. And it turns out that before we began our inhalation studies, there were only two or three animal inhalation toxicology studies out there looking at the PCBs. So we began by studying aerochlor 1242, just because we know it has a highly, that 1242 is enriched in the lower chlorinated congeners, which tend to be more volatile. We then decided that that wasn't as relevant to what we were measuring in Chicago air, where we've been doing a lot of work. So we tried to create a mixture of PCBs that when aerosol vaporized in chambers would create a profile that resembled the Chicago air that we've been measuring. We've also done studies on individual congeners, including PCB 11, PCB 3, and then some recent work with CAM Plus, which is the Chicago air mixture that's now supplemented with PCB 11. And this mixture represents what we're seeing in the indoor environment in Chicago, in East Chicago, and also in Iowa. Now, our studies include acute, subacute, and subchronic, and we're now going to longer time points and more complex mixtures and higher doses. Now, one of the important things you're going to see through the talk I'm going to give that maybe will strike you a bit differently from what you heard from Kent is that we are not using Aerochlor measurements. We're using measurements, technique that delivers quantitation on all 209 congeners. And in particular, we have designed our analytical methodology so we don't miss the lower chlorinated congeners, the top, the lightest 20 to 40 congeners. So you'll see a lot more enrichment of those lower chlorinated PCBs in the profiles you'll see from this talk, and that's really a product of our different analytical techniques that we're employing. So in 2010, we published our first inhalation study, and I just have one quick slide to kind of summarize what we found there. This was an acute and subacute inhalation study. We were able to generate Aerochlor 1242 vapors among rats, and we found, much to our surprise, very short half-life for the sum of the PCBs, with ranging from the liver at 5.6 hours up to blood 9.7 hours. We had expected longer time half-lives for this. The lung, liver, adipose tissue levels especially were accumulating PCBs. These were higher than the brain or the blood. And in 10-day exposures, we were able to deliver a large amount of PCB and quantify the exposures organ by organ. And we did some toxicology endpoint analysis as well in this short-term exposure, and we found minimal toxicity as one would expect from such a short study with a chronic toxicant. So then in our next study, we went to studying the Chicago air mixture in a subchronic exposure. We were able to match in the atmospheres the rats were breathing the profile of urban air as measured in Chicago over a four-week period. The inhalation exposures led to a substantial body burden, mostly of the tri- to hexachlorinated biphenyls, so these homolog groups with 3, 4, 5, or 6 chlorines on the biphenyl rings. And we found that there was a distinct congener spectrum across tissues, whether it be lung, serum, liver, brain, adipose tissue. And in particular of interest, we also found that there were accumulation of neurotoxic PCBs in the brain, including the congeners 28, 105, and 118. And this is what that CAM profile looked like. We were generating 520 micrograms per cubic meter simply by vaporizing this mixture from a liquid at 25 degrees Celsius. And so it seems like the labeling is a little bit messed up on the slide as the transfer from PowerPoint to PDF. I'm sorry about that. But what you'll see is this enrichment of the lower chlorinated PCBs and then still retaining some of the higher chlorinated PCBs as well. So we get the full suite of measured congeners in the CAM. And so this slide 8 here is showing the congener profile in lung on the upper right and blood on the lower side. And we find that the profiles are quite similar from tissue to tissue. And in this case, most particular of interest was that we had high levels in the tissue of 28, 52, and 118. And many of these are recurring in terms of what we see, but there are some differences from tissues to tissues. On the left here in the table, you can see that we had a substantial accumulation of the congeners in the tissue, in the blood, in the lung. But we also see that both our sham-exposed animals that were breathing clean air in a laboratory that has never had PCBs introduced into it, and our sentinel animals that never left the animal room after coming in, they also have tissue burdens of PCBs. And this reminds us that PCBs are everywhere. They're in every building, every room. They're in the feed that the animals have, and indeed the food that we as humans eat. So you always have to look at the responses in animals that have been deliberately exposed with appropriate controls, because these are ubiquitous exposures and ubiquitous compounds. Well, because of some very interesting findings associated with PCB-11 in our group, and I should say that most studies that have been done in the past did not even look for PCB-11 because it was never an aerochlor PCB, and therefore, if you don't measure it, you don't find it oftentimes. And with our methodology, looking at all 209 congeners, we were now able to see that PCB-11 was an important congener, both in indoor air, outdoor air, associated with the manufacture of paint. And it is, therefore, when it's in paint, paint is both a primary source and a secondary source. It's secondary because it can absorb some of the legacy PCBs, but it's primary in that it is off-gassing PCB-11 from the formulation. And I'm told that this is especially true if it's yellow or green paint, which has these yellow azo pigments. So we were able to obtain some C14 labeled PCB-11 for a time course study. And PCB-11, for those who aren't aware, is 3,3-prime dichlorobiphenyl. So it's a 2-chlorine homologue PCB, and we were able to then conduct exposures in the manner I'll show you on the next slide here. So we have rats that are in glass chambers through which air is being drawn, clean air, and we collect the air that is coming out of that chamber. And so the animals are dosed by instillation of the C14 PCB-11 into the lung. And then we are able to see if any of that comes out of the lung through exhalation or any other process. We also collect the urine and the feces separately from the study, and we look at the distribution and absorption and metabolism of PCB-11 over time. So here's a heat map that shows us basically what happens over the course of this. So we use 6 time points. We started with 200 minutes, and we quickly realized that we had to go to shorter time points in order to capture what was happening with PCB-11. So at 12 minutes already, we see that it's moved from the lung to the blood to the muscle and the liver, where we find it especially. And there's virtually none in the lung already at 12 minutes after exposure. By 25 minutes, it's just starting to distribute to the skin and the contents of the duodenum. So we're measuring both the tissues and the matter within the gut tissues. And so at 25 minutes, it's already in the duodenum. 50 minutes, we see stomach, jejunum, ileum. And 100 minutes, it's largely being distributed further through the gut. And by 200 minutes, we find it in the skin, the urine, somewhat in the adipose tissue, but especially coming to the jejunum and the colon. And then by 720 minutes, most has been excreted via the feces, some by the urine, and there remains some in the guts that's on the way to being excreted as fecal through the largely as metabolites. We're also looked at metabolism of this to the hydroxy PCBs, the PCB sulfates, and the phase two metabolites over this time course. So we can look at the data in another way. This plot shows the time points post-exposure, 12 minutes to 720 minutes. And then we see the distribution of the C14 label on the x-axis, with the percent of the administered radioactivity represented in each of those tissues. And so if you look at the first bar, the 12-minute there, the dominant color is this lavender, at least on my screen it's lavender, and this represents the liver and the digestive tissue. We also see in the carcass and brain substantial amounts of the PCB-11 and its metabolites. And as you go on down through the time points, you see increasingly the digestive and matter and feces in the pink, and the kidney and urine, especially urine, in the yellow hashed bar. What's important to this is that the part that is exhaled is represented by the far left blank bar, and you can see there's less than 0.2% of the administered dose that was exhaled from the animal. This was an instillation model because this material is so expensive we can't do a typical inhalation, but this is some indication that we have very rapid and almost complete uptake from the lung of the PCB11 and then distribution to the rest of the tissue with fecal elimination as the majority pathway for excretion. Also of interest here is to look at the adipose tissue, which is, if I can mark it with here, here's the adipose tissue. No, that isn't working here. So in this bar, we can see that there's a small amount of 12 minutes. We actually at 25 minutes have more and 100 minutes, but then it's dropping off by 720 minutes as well. So we don't see the kind of accumulation of this in adipose tissue that we might see with the higher chlorinated PCBs, which is a well-known phenomenon. This is the time course. We looked at 36 different tissues and tissue matter, so we had a full profile for this, and as I showed, nearly 100% mass balance, so we knew we were finding all of the C14 label from the PCB11. And so what you can see is throughout all these tissues, we have a very rapid first-order elimination and then a slower second phase of elimination that is continuing on to 720 minutes. And as shown in panel A, as all the tissue levels are declining, we see it increasing in the urine and the gut material, so the urine in B, the gut material in figure C, and then the digestive matter and colon in D. And the half-lives, the initial half-lives on the order of 9 to 33 minutes, and the secondary times are still quite a bit less than a day. So when we measure in our subjects that I'm going to talk about next in our human studies, when we measure PCB11, that means that this their exposure happened that day or the day before. Because of these rapid elimination times, we're measuring current exposure to PCBs when we measure PCB11 in our school kids. So from this, I summarized most of this already, but 99.8% was absorbed. We had very high concentrations quickly, but it is being metabolized, with 50% excreted by 12 hours and the rest of it in the digestive matter, so about to be excreted, short half-lives. And importantly to us, the phase 2 metabolites dominated in the systemic circulation. And therefore, in our studies, we're now starting to look at phase 2 metabolites in urine as a potential improved biomarker compared to looking at the parent PCB11 in the blood of the school children that we're studying. So that takes me to that study, leaving the animals now and turning towards our epidemiologic study, which is a community-based participatory study with two cohorts that is designed to assess exposures to PCBs among adolescent children and their mothers, and with a special attention towards the inhalation route of exposure. We call it the ESOP study, which is an acronym for Airborne Exposures to Semi-Volatile Organic Pollutants. And it's important to keep in mind that although we think of PCBs as being low volatility compared to, say, VOCs or a lot of compounds that we as toxicologists or epidemiologists consider, they are volatile enough that we can get substantial exposure at levels that could potentially be of interest from a toxicologic standpoint. And the lower the chlorination, the lower the more volatile they tend to be. So the ESOP study is a prospective cohort study in two communities. One is East Chicago, which is perched there at the southern end of Lake Michigan between Chicago and Gary, Indiana. And then our, if you will, control community, which is Columbus Junction, Iowa, which is just about an hour's drive southeast of Iowa City, where I'm located. We chose to study East Chicago for several reasons. One, they have a very high record of legacy pollution. Much of the armaments for World War II were constructed here. There continues to be refineries. BP has a large refinery there. There's a large steel mill and steel works there. And they're nestled right in and among the community of East Chicago. It's a community that has high exposures to a number of agents. When you visit there, you have a strong odor of VOCs much of the time. And importantly, this Indiana Harbor and Shipping Canal, which is shown in this figure labeled IHSC, is slated for a navigational dredge to allow large ships to be able to come into the harbor and into the canal. But in the process of conducting that navigational dredge, when they remove roughly a meter of sediment from the canal, they will be exposing basically 1960s layers of sediment, which are heavily laden in PCBs, PAHs, trace metals, and a number of other things. And these will be placed into the CDF, which is labeled here on the left side, and that's the combined disposal facility, which is largely you can imagine a gigantic bathtub with large sides bermed up, and they're going to fill it in with the sediment that will come from the harbor and ship canal. And this is of concern to the community because it's about 400 meters from the high school and the middle school, and not all that far from a couple of other schools and the community itself. So the community, we've worked closely with them because of their concerns. We've also worked with the Army Corps of Engineers, who are responsible for conducting this dredge. And the most people will agree that in 30 years from now, when this dredging is complete, the sediments will be better contained and the air levels will probably be improved. However, the community is concerned about what happens in that intervening time when the sediments are being brought up and placed into the confined disposal facility. So contrast this with our other community, which is Columbus Junction, Iowa. And actually, it's not Columbus Junction itself, but Columbus Community School District, which serves a host of very small towns and rural areas and largely farmlands around this portion. Columbus Junction is located at the confluence of the Cedar River and the Iowa River, just upstream from where the Iowa River meets the Mississippi River, which is just caught on the right-hand side of this figure. And so the town is... has a very small population, as is typical of this part of the country. You can see here on this slide the downtown. We kind of jokingly call it the downtown. It's about maybe 20 buildings, and that's circled there. The schools, both the middle school and the high school, are shown in the bottom left. And important to this community is that there's a very substantial number of immigrants who live here. Initially, people from Mexico and Central America, increasingly people from Burma and Somalia, and they're drawn to this area because of employment in the meatpacking industry, which is very prominent in this town as it is in many small towns in Iowa and in the Midwest. So the study is illustrated in this figure. We do air sampling at the homes and the schools. We enroll children, middle school children and their mothers, and have a variety of questionnaires that they address, and this is done in both English and Spanish. We collect DNA samples. Annually, we collect 5 tubes of blood. We collect samples, air samples, 4 times a year, indoor and out. And then the one of the tubes is processed for lipid profile. We also do fasting glucose because the community is concerned about obesity. And then we do a full congener PCB analysis for all 209 congeners, and now we're also doing 64 hydroxy PCB metabolites on each blood sample. So our aims in this study are to measure exposures at home and schools in both cohorts, to characterize the blood and urine for PCBs and their metabolites as a way of doing biomonitoring. We collect a variety of data by questionnaire, and then we're utilizing our exposure and questionnaire data to develop exposure models for the atmospheric PCB congener exposures, accounting for exposures through other activities and dietary exposures as well. We've enrolled 264, and you can see the population of each of the cohorts with mothers and their children. And in a few cases, we have more than one child enrolled from a given family, so that's why the children numbers exceed the mother numbers in this study. So in terms of the cohort demographics, I'll just say a couple things about this because I think it's important to recognize. So this slide shows East Chicago and Columbus Junction schools that we're studying. We're also studying the high schools as the children move from middle school to high school. We follow them. But if you look at the middle schools, they're built in 68 and 76 for East Chicago. So that's in the time frame when we might see PCB materials of construction. And in the Columbus Community Middle School, built in 1918, it has had renovations over the years that we believe contributed PCBs to that school environment. And you see the enrollment. Importantly, free and discounted lunch. These populations, these communities have a substantial number of people who live at or near poverty, and this is to some extent reflected in the free and discounted lunch participation rates. High number of Hispanic kids. If you look at Columbus Junction, you see we're at about 62%. The difference comes that there are far more African-American children in East Chicago, and these rates are very low in rural Iowa. Household incomes are low, a lot of people living below the poverty line, and the educational attainment in these communities is with some 27% in East Chicago with less than high school education, 34% in Columbus Junction. Just a few things to further characterize the cohorts. Of course, the children are all 13 at enrollment because we enroll them at seventh grade. The mothers have the ages of 41 or 46 years. And you can see that among this population, the rates of breastfeeding for the East Chicago mothers, 33% of our children in the study were breastfed, whereas in Columbus Junction, 68%. And this reflects largely that the Hispanic mothers and the white mothers of European descent participate in breastfeeding at a higher rate than the African-American mothers in East Chicago. I mentioned earlier that the community, as well as being concerned about PCBs, is concerned about obesity. And you can see that the mothers in East Chicago, 61% have BMI over 30, and 41% in Columbus Junction. And indeed, Indiana and Iowa are among those states where obesity is a problem. So because of the community's concern about this, we did add lipid profile and fasting glucose to the measurements we do, and we report these back to the subjects so that they can act on that if they have concerns. So in terms of exposure measurements, I've alluded to this a bit, what we do. The air sampling, we did active air sampling with high-vol samplers side by side with passive air samplers. Now we've gone to using exclusively passive air samplers, which capture over 90% of the PCBs in the air. And these consist of basically what looks like two salad bowls inverted with holes drilled in them and a polyurethane foam disc that goes in between. This absorbs PCBs from the air over time, and we deploy these with some of them with deperation compounds. So we have C13 labeled PCBs that will be given off from the puff disc. So over time, we can see what the release rate was, and then from that develop models for the uptake of PCBs. And you can see that we've amassed a large number of these samples over the years of the study so far, with over 3,000 air samples collected and nearly 1,000 blood samples collected from our cohorts. I'll show a little bit of data on what we find, and these then are congener profiles from PCB1 to PCB209, and on the top, what we're showing is basically a composite of 38 Columbus Junction homes and the error levels that were observed in there, with error bars showing the standard deviation among those 38 homes. And so what you see is that on this top panel, the highest PCB level was PCB11, followed perhaps by 52 and some of the co-eluting 61, 70, 74, 76. So when the congener numbers are shown with several numbers as slashes, these are co-eluting PCBs in some of the analyses, and so we've combined those data into a single peak. So PCB11 is featured very prominently in the Columbus Junction homes. Here, the bottom panel here, B, is the Columbus Junction schools, 12 samples from two different schools, and you can see the school levels are higher by some sevenfold on average than are the home levels. But again, now you see that PCB11 is no longer the most prominent congener, but instead 52 and some of the higher PCBs that might reflect off-gassing from light ballasts or caulk or other sources that Kent talked about a moment ago. If we go to, so this is Columbus Junction, our rural Iowa community. If we go to East Chicago, we find that East Chicago levels are higher. And again, PCB11 is important, but we see 52, 40, 41, 71. And in the schools, again, it looks more like the contribution of caulk and ballast and some of the errachlor, and less of the some of the other sources that I've identified at the lower and the left end in terms of this plot. So what are we doing with these data? Well, one thing we're doing is we through our activity questionnaires, we are tracking where kids spend their time. So how much time do they spend at home, indoors, at home, outdoors, in school, indoors and outdoors, and how much time in other places. And we do this for the mothers as well. And we do this annually, and we do this across four different seasons. So from that activity data, we can figure out how much time they spend, and we're measuring the concentrations indoors and outdoors at home and schools. So we can put that in the model as the concentration. And since we're doing this for each PCB, which is here labeled J, PCBJ, for each J PCB, we can come up with an exposure metric that sums their exposure over the course of a typical year of their occupancy in the various indoor and outdoor locations. And so from this, we can then also sum them and come up with a total estimate of their PCB exposure. And so this is work that's ongoing. Just to show some preliminary data on this, here for mothers and children, mothers in the red, children in the blue, top is East Chicago, bottom is Columbus Junction. You can see that we're modeling higher exposures for East Chicago, probably mostly attributed to the higher levels in the schools. And then the children are actually showing higher levels of mass inhaled than the mothers do, and that's because the children are at school and the mothers, to a large extent, are at home, and the levels in the home are lower than the levels in the schools. On the bottom, looking at Columbus Junction, we find a similar trend. Although the levels are lower, we find that the children's inhalation mass per year exceeds that of the mothers. If we look at then how do we interpret this, in the aggregate, we see that the East Chicago homes were higher than the Columbus Junction homes, but we do have some outliers, and I want to make sure and point this out because this is an important element to this. One of the homes in East Chicago has a sum concentration of 164 nanograms per cubic meter, so essentially 50 times higher than the mean. And then in Columbus Junction, there's two homes that are outliers. And one of these Columbus Junction homes has a very high outdoor concentration. And if you look at the profile, it looks like somebody dumped a lot of AirClor 1254 in their backyard, because it has a very clear 1254 signature. So there are, in any large study like this, you're going to find some particular cases that are quite concerning and might indeed be candidates for a closer look and a remediation, because those present a high hazard environment. Turning to the biomonitoring then, I mentioned that we collect 30 mils of blood annually from each of the subjects. We measure their lipid profile, 209 PCB congeners, 64 hydroxy PCBs, and next year we propose to study urine and the PCB sulfates in the urine based on our animal studies, which have shown that to be a robust biomarker. So summary data here, on the top left is the sum PCBs, and on the right is the OH PCBs, and what we see is that there aren't huge differences between the communities, but in both settings, the mothers have higher total PCB congener sums than do the children. And when we look at what are the most frequently detected congeners, you can see on the bottom table here that the children are enriched with lower chlorinated PCBs. And you see 11, 15, 8, 3, and 2 here. In East Chicago and somewhat similarly in Columbus Junction. But the mothers their sera are enriched with the more of the higher molecular weight congeners that are associated with past exposure to AirClors. So this stands to reason, but there are some that carry throughout. 153, for instance, is important, as is the congener grouping of 138, 163, and 129. So we're starting to look at this and starting to compare this to individual source data for materials in schools and homes to understand this signature better. When we look at congener profiles in the serum, these are the sum of roughly 30 to 37 in each group, and if we look at the concentrations, you can see in all four, PCB11 comes out as a very prominent congener in the blood, and among the mothers, 153 is high, but in the children, 153 does not stand out. So it's interesting to look at these, and really it's quite dramatically different looking at children versus their mothers. So this is important because to some extent you'd think that they have a similar diet, perhaps. They're sharing life in the same household, but children obviously have exposure to the schools and other areas that the mothers do not share with them. So I think that's an important lesson for us to take note of. So from the ESOP study, so far we can conclude that our passive air sampling is working, and it's especially good at looking at mono to hexachlorinated PCB exposures. We find significant inhalation exposures. We also are doing modeling where we're capturing dietary exposures, and dietary exposures for the total PCB load seem to be somewhere around 50 to 75% of the exposure, but in some circumstances, the inhalation exposure can even dominate over the dietary exposures when we look at the whole sum of PCBs. The older schools are tenfold higher source of PCBs than most homes. As I pointed out, the children's sera are enriched with the lower chlorinated congeners. PCB11 appears as a high congener in women and their children, whereas 153 seems to dominate in the adults, but not in the children. And that reflects, we believe, legacy exposure, namely exposure to the AirClors. So I'm going to stop there and just highlight the members of the team that have worked on the study. It takes a lot of people to run a large study like this, and I want to acknowledge all of their contributions. And I can't take the time to name them all and talk about them, but they're listed here, and I thank them very much. And then also our subjects, so this is a community-based participatory research grant, so they're very good partners to work with, and they've been as tremendously helpful as have been our community advisory boards, and we appreciate the support we get for this work from NIEHS through the Superfund program. And with that, I'll stop, and we can have some questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Peter. I know we're approaching 4 o'clock. Justin, are we able to keep the lines open a little longer than 4 o'clock?
Yep, the lines can remain open.
Okay, all right. So we will try to see how long people's tolerance limit is here. So let's go to the phones first and see if we have some questions that I guess would probably be first directed to Peter, and then we could just open it up for questions in general. And we do have quite a few that have been typed in, too, so we'll try to get to them as well. But for the phones first, anyone on the line that would like to ask a question of either Peter or Kent? If I don't hear that, let me take some questions, and then we can always come back to the phones. I wanted to get a question because it's here from Robert Herrick, who I had mentioned in my presentation as being largely instrumental for bringing this whole PCB in buildings, vis-a-vis certainly the cork, to light. And Dr. Herrick asks, what is known about the likelihood that buildings that have PCBs in indoor caulking and sealants have it in outdoor materials and vice versa?
Well, that's a good question, Bob. Maybe this is a question for Kent. I know that there's been really nice work from a Danish study that I cited in one of my slides looking at caulk and its role and somewhat about indoor and outdoor, but very high levels in both. But, you know, obviously the caulk on the inside is a direct avenue to inside indoor air, whereas for the outdoor to come in is, you know, there's more dilution of that outside. I would also think that perhaps, depending on where the school is located, if the caulk is on, say, a warm south side wall or something, it could long ago have off-gassed some of the lower chlorinated congeners, and what might remain would be the higher congeners. But Kent, can you chime in too?
Yeah, it's good to hear from Dr. Herrick, and it's a great question, and I hesitate to say that we have enough information to answer it well. We know that caulks and sealants with high PCB levels have been found both inside and outside buildings. I don't know that we've seen enough building data right now to say conclusively whether we're more likely to find them on the exterior as opposed to the interior of buildings. My sense is that, you know, there was a lot of use on the outside of buildings. One of the reasons is because they were typically higher quality caulks and designed to really provide that barrier. But we've seen high concentrations in sealants enough inside of buildings to I think, be conclusive. I'd also mention work that David McIntosh at EH&E et al. Published a couple of years ago for another school in the New England area, in which the primary source there was caulk. They didn't have any fluorescent light ballasts. They saw indoor air levels that were elevated, and it looked like they had some success in terms of a barrier approach for reducing the emissions into the indoor air. And I think most of those caulks we're at the indoor-outdoor barrier, if my memory serves me well.
Okay. Let me ask another question. This comes from Victoria Leonard. Dust is an important source of toxic ingestion in infants and toddlers who have much higher hand-to-mouth behaviors than elementary-age children. What can you infer from your study findings about the effects of PCBs in childcare centers on very young children who are growing and developing much faster than 6 to 10-year-olds?
So in this study, you know, we're enrolling kids at age 13, so we can't really say much about the children at age groups younger than that. What we can see is that the levels of the higher chlorinated PCBs that you might more expect to come from the dust ingestion were not reflected in the serum samples from these kids. As I showed, their profile was very much skewed towards the lower and more volatile PCBs. So at least at this time point, there isn't the signature of ingestion of the legacy Aerochlor higher molecular weight congeners any more in their serum.
And this is Kent. So, I agree with the person that had this question that we would expect the younger children to have likely more ingestion of PCBs associated with dust and soils, perhaps because of their higher contact rates. We did modeling estimates for a 4 to 5 year old age group based on the levels found in the schools. Again, I don't think we have enough information to conclusively say that younger children have higher exposures from these dust sources, but we certainly do recommend in cases where there are PCBs in schools or preschools that part of the best practices be a fairly thorough cleaning to reduce the dust to the lowest practical levels.
Okay, thank you. There was a question I lost it, but I remember its context was where in I guess this is for you, Peter. The studies where they were finding the PCBs in homes, where do you think that was coming from?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. And one of the things we're doing now is going into some of the homes where we have higher levels of PCBs observed and sampling materials inside the homes. We've thought about this quite a lot. Our polyurethane foam discs that we use in our air samplers look a whole lot like the pillows and cushions on sofas, which are often polyurethane. So we have some natural sinks for PCBs in homes, and we can perhaps study those to reveal what materials are producing these. But we know that the paint is one, and then we certainly know about caulk and light ballast, but typically we don't see the levels of those in homes that we would see in schools, particularly the fluorescent light ballasts. And a lot of homes built after that period of time where the PCBs were used will have substantial levels of PCB. And I'm in a building that was built a year and a half ago, brand new, without recycling materials, and it has elevated levels of PCB 11 and 52 in it. We know that they're appearing in new buildings as well as older buildings.
Well, here's a follow-up question from Carl Steinman, and again, this would be directed at you, Peter, I think. Mothers and children in both the East Chicago and Columbia Junction communities have similar PCB 11 serum concentrations reflecting recent exposures. What is the suspected source of the PCB 11 exposure?
Yellow and green paint pigment is our suspected source. We've absolutely determined that it's there. It can be there at fairly high levels. And when we look at 11 places in Chicago that manufacture paint, the profiles of 11, I'm told, are elevated there. So, again, we've actually measured paint pigments of different types, and that's been published by Ding-Fei Hu and Kerry Hornbuckle in Environmental Science and Technology, showing the levels of PCB 11 in those paint pigments.
Okay. Kent, anything to add to that?
Nope, that's a great answer.
Randy Hawley asks, do the non-Aerochlor PCBs show lesser toxic effects compared to the legacy PCBs? In other words, in Dr. Thorne's slides, are the PCB 11 in children of less concern than the PCB 153 in adults?
Yeah, that's a great question. With PCBs, we haven't talked about this today because I think that you'll be hearing about that next week, but there's the issue of the dioxin-like PCBs and the neurotoxic PCBs. With the non-Aerochlor PCBs, they haven't been studied much, so virtually nothing is known about them. And our studies of 11 are essentially the first toxicological studies that have been done. That said, my suspicion is that they are more rapidly metabolized, and quite possibly the parent compounds are not toxic, but we have to determine what about the metabolites. Are they, and we're looking at endpoints, oxidative stress, induction, inflammation, genotoxicity, and we've proposed a developmental study as well. But people who are used to looking at PCB structures and look at 11 would tell you that they think 11 will probably be quite a bit less toxic than the PCB congeners that are thought to be the worst actors.
Okay. My colleague Jureen asked, do you suggest that when schools test, that they test for individual congeners?
Well, this is such an expensive endeavor. When you think about going into any kind of a routine testing mode, it's going to be quite costly. My sense is that doing some kind of an analysis method that includes the lower chlorinated congeners in it is very useful and provides important information. And I'm afraid that when we only look for the aerochlores, especially when we're not using methodology that gets the first 20 congeners, we're missing an important part of the story. So I'd love to see some more routine kind of measurement capabilities, but still that include the first 20 congeners, at least some of those, as indicator compounds. And indeed, 11 could be a good one to be able to detect. And I think that's happening now that more people are aware of its importance.
Kent, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I agree with what Peter said, certainly. And I would just suggest it would be really useful to have some more congener-specific information from indoor environments in general. And I wonder, you know, the feasibility when people perform these measurements, whether most of the screening-type measurements might be the standard aerochlore approach, but whether organizations can invest enough to at least collect or analyze a subset on a congener-specific basis to provide the kinds of information Peter was talking about. I think it'll help us get it at sources, too, so it's useful information.
Okay. I have my own question here, and that is, you know, Peter, I noticed that you used the PU, you know, the polyurethane foam passive air samplers in your ESOPs study. There has been certainly some interest in trying to bring those types of sampling devices into schools, because especially in New York City, where we literally have hundreds of buildings that have not really been characterized as far as indoor air levels. You know, the EPA, accepted methods are, you know, is for an active, pumping procedure. And we'd love to be able to get, you know, these much more time-integrated samples that the passive air samplers provide, and, you know, less expense, and a lot easier to use. The question being, they're not EPA methods, so there's always that question. And from what I understand, I think passive air samplers would at least in theory, do a good job with vapor phase PCBs, but how well are they capturing the particle-bound PCBs?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. I mean, as an exposure assessment person myself, I prefer to have an active air sampler where I know with precision what volume of air was actually sampled when I calculate a concentration, and I know that I'm collecting, like with our high-vol samplers, we were collecting vapor on XAD, and we're collecting particles on filter material, so we can analyze both of them. And what we found when we did that is that we were capturing more than 90% of the total PCB, but the subtext of that is we're capturing especially the more volatile, lower chlorinated congeners, and perhaps we're undersampling the highest congenated, highest chlorinated congeners are perhaps being undersampled. But for us, having a primary interest in the inhalation route of exposure, that seems to be a fair trade-off. The other thing I would say is the kind of study we could do if we were doing only high vols would be very limited compared to being able to deploy in 160 homes and schools a large number of samplers over a prolonged period of time. The third thing I would say is there's been some really wonderful work both looking at PAH sampling with this method and PCB sampling with this method, and looking at loss of deprivation compounds and use of meteorological models to more precisely estimate the air exposure rate, so the cubic meters per day of air sampled by these passive monitors. And so we can model the exposure rates very predictably and reliably, and we've validated this with deprivation compounds. And so I'm feeling better and better about these samplers all the time in terms of having a good idea what their what the air sampling rate is for these. And it's about 6.2 cubic meters per day under our average conditions in our community on the, for the outdoor samples. And the indoor samples is about 2.6 meters cubic meters per day.
Ken, you want to add anything to that?
No, just that I'd be really interested in learning more about this. Like you, Mark, we've been thinking about this. And my biggest concern in indoor environments, of course, are the particle-bound PCBs and the effective sampling rates or exclusion rates of those with various sampler configurations. So that's great.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that we can really do justice to the particle-bound PCB exposures. Those, as I tried to indicate, are probably undersampled. And I would point to a recent article on these passive samplers published in Environmental Science and Technology, Volume 47, in 2013, first author Petrich, P-E-T-R-I-C-H. And that's really shows all this work with passive air sampling rates for semi-volatile compounds on polyurethane foam passive samplers.
Okay, thank you. Patricia Cassano asks, what method was used for the conjurer analysis, 1668 or something else?
It's not 1668, but it's based on that. It's a GC10MMS method, triple quad, and the extraction component of it and the GC part of it is super important, because we are capturing all the congeners from the first to the 209th. And it's been extensively published in papers by Kerry Hornbuckle from our group. And I can refer to those further if someone wants to contact me by email. I can send them those papers or the links.
And Mark, for our study, this was through a contract laboratory, NEA's PACE Analytical. They used a modified EPA 8082 method called the Comprehensive Quantitative Congener Specific Analysis. And it resolves 146 individual chromatographic peaks. And then the subset of those that potentially could be mixtures of congeners, when they're potentially ones that could be present in aerochlores, are modeled as to the relative amounts. And after learning about this information from the University of Iowa, I've gone back and looked at the data that we've collected from our buildings. In our case, PCB11 and PCB17 co-elute. PCB17 is present both in aerochlores 1242 and 1254. Interestingly enough, though, for this particular chromatographic peak, we saw a higher PCB17-18 ratio, which suggests that some PCB11 could be occurring there as well, and it may be at levels that are consistent with what Peter has shown today. So that's an interesting finding for us.
Okay. And Kent, in your some of your profiles, it seemed like you had very low reporting of 1 through 40, or especially 1 through 20. Do you think that's because it's just not there, or do you think that's a product of the methodology?
So for the indoor air, you know, we had lower levels of some of the less chlorinated congeners than you're reporting, but we still saw most of them.
Okay.
That we'd expect to see, I guess. You know, I think one of the differences is that, you know, at least in the one school where we have congener-specific measurements, we're seeing higher levels of the more chlorinated congeners than you report from your work.
Yeah.
And perhaps more than we would expect, and so that may be dust-bound. I will say for the measurement of the caulk at that school, there was an absence of the lower chlorinated congeners, you know, once you get below about, I forget what the cutoff point was, but somewhere below PCB 40. And one of the things we're wondering is whether there was actually depletion of those lower chlorinated congeners from these exterior caulks over the 43 years in the building.
Right. It's probably all gone.
Yeah, we suspect that's why we didn't see it.
Yeah, I think we're all going to have to be gone too soon. I'm going to take one last question and then a couple of housekeeping chores, and then we're going to have to wrap it up because I actually have something at 4:30 that I got to take care of. Jennifer DiNicola asks, with the 12 dioxin-like PCBs, shouldn't we be more concerned with making sure that these 12 are not prevalent in the air and or dust, in addition to testing for total PCBs?
Well, that's a good question, and that might be one of the topics for next week's webinar. To that, I would say that, you know, we know about the toxicity of the things that we've studied the most, and, you know, exposure is part of it, and toxicity is the other part. And if you have no exposure to something that's toxic, you haven't very much risk. So I think we have to look at the exposures. We have to look at the congeners, and some of these may be developmental toxicants. There's some that are just recently being discovered to have carcinogenic or genotoxic potency that aren't dioxin-like and that hasn't been characterized before. So despite decades of study, we're learning a lot about PCBs and individual congeners that we never realized. So sure, we do the TEQ and the NEQ kind of calculations, looking at our exposure profiles both in humans and in rodent studies, but we can't close our eyes to the importance of all of the congeners, not just the dioxin-like congeners.
Kent, anything to add?
Just that, as Peter said, you know, when we have the data, and we did this for the one school where we've got the congener-specific data of calculating TEQs for total dioxin-like PCBs. And in this environment, in terms of the absolute amount of those 12 PCBs, congeners 118 and 105 dominated, with lesser extents of a few others and none measured for several of the other dioxin-like congeners. 105 and 118 have relatively low toxicity equivalents among the 12. But I agree with Peter. Is, you know, I think recent toxicological research has pointed out that, you know, we ought not to close our minds and only focus on those particular 12 congeners.
Okay, I have to make a couple of plugs here. The next Risk E-Learning webinar, PCBs in Schools, Identifying and Reducing Health Risk, which we certainly spilled into today, and is scheduled for April 28th. Registration information is available on the SRRP Risk E-Learning website and on the CLUIN webpage. Also, I'd like to make a plug for an upcoming PCB conference, the 8th International PCBs Workshop, Exposures, Effects, Remediation, and Regulation, co-hosted by the University of Iowa Superfund Research Program and Boston University Superfund Research Program. And that will take place October 5th through 9th of this year in lovely Woods Hole, Massachusetts. So stay tuned on that. And also, stay up to date on our latest SRP news and events by following SRP Twitter feeds at SRP under slash NIEHS. So with that, I think we have run out of time. If you have additional questions, you can contact the presenters via email. I think you have access to that. Their email addresses is on the seminar homepage on CLUIN, which is linked to and from the SRP Risky Learning webpage. If you submitted an online question, we did not have time to get to it, it will be forwarded to the presenters. And with that, I would like to thank our presenters, Ken Thomas and Peter Thorne, for their wonderful presentations today and for sharing their vast amount of knowledge on this subject with us. And this concludes today's presentation. Thank you very much for your participation.